you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, Expanse fans, and welcome to episode 6 of The Churn, episode 7 of The Expanse, The Seventh Man. I'm Cher Martinetti, managing editor of Fangirls, and with me as always,
Adam Swiderski, editor-in-chief of Sci-Fi Wire.
And we are, of course, as always, are going to be joined by Ty and Daniel, who are going to help us break down the episode. And then later on during the podcast, special effects supervisor Bob Monroe is going to be joining us, which there's a whole bunch of questions.
I don't know what we're going to talk to him about.
Absolutely not.
The effects in this show just,
they're awful.
Second fiddle. Yeah, really
so bad. So as always, if you're listening, please go ahead and rate us on iTunes or however you're listening to us. So we're on Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, basically everywhere you want your podcast to be. And if we're not, track us down and let us know, because then we'll get it there.
And before we start, I just got to give props to Cher for that Thomas Jane interview that we did as our bonus episode.
Thank you.
That was really something. He is such an interesting interview, and I love the phrase, which I can't repeat, that he coined.
Which one?
For social media.
Oh, that was like a...
That's a thing now.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
That and the eating our own shit are the two most loved things that he said, but I'm really happy that that happened, because it was a couple weeks in the making, and I know that he really does not love doing stuff like that. But he actually enjoyed it, and he paid me a compliment, which was amazing that he, you know, wished that all his interviews were
there.
Like
you
that.
Go. Yes. That should be the tagline for The Churn.
I know.
I wish that all interviews were like this, Thomas Jane.
Oh, that should be.
There you
or
go.
We could just use like one of his profanity laden rants.
Exactly.
As the
on the
music.
Just put that on the poster. Yeah, that'll be good.
So also, if you guys are listening and you haven't read the books, or you're wanting to catch up on the books, since there's the actual novels and the novellas, those are all available on Orbit. You can go onto Amazon.com and get those, or get them through the James S.A. Corey website, or go to a local small independent bookstore, because we want to support them more than anyone else. Forget James and James S.A. Corey. Just support the bookstores. So this episode... The crew of the Rossi, there's a lot going on. We're starting to see, not just with them, but with the OPA, a lot going on. Bobby Draper is reliving the attack on Ganymede. And it seems that the MCRN and the Martians need no more than they're letting on. Amos gets triggered, which I really didn't want to use that word, but it's accurate. He gets triggered and is immediately brought back to a time and a part of his life that is not a necessarily happy one. And this is going to set Amos down on a very interesting path. And the OPA.
Earth, Mars, on the brink. What will the OPA do?
It's not even that. It's just the OPA. You know, Anderson Dawes goes and makes a play.
The triumphant return of Anderson Dawes.
Yeah, and he's about to shake things up just a teeny bit. And
I also enjoyed the return of the... lie detector pill.
Yes, the
which
lie.
Which we those haven't seen since episode 4 of season 1. I think it was episode 4.
And then we also, we haven't seen it since almost the beginning.
Yeah.
And then our boy Holden last week was like, I don't want to be the one who decides who lives and dies. And then decides, nah, I was just kidding. Let me go kill somebody. But the OPA already got their hands.
Foiled. Yeah.
Yeah. What is going on?
Man, this was a very big, for me, like, universe-expanding episode. Having characters like Anderson Dawes, who was a supporting player, now very much in the thick of things. Cortazar playing a bigger role than I ever expected when, you know, he was first introduced on the show. So, to me, that was the biggest story of this episode, is the way that we've been following... I mean, obviously, the Rossi crew are kind of our main entry point. Mm-hmm. We've got a Vassarella on Earth. Now Bobby's story is starting to take... It's like the characters that you care about following expanded, I felt, in this show pretty significantly in this episode.
Yeah.
And That was very interesting for me. And very interesting, the other thing that was interesting to me, and you'd watched ahead when you were talking about Diogo's radicalization and kind of seeing that scene that he had with Anderson Dawes, where you see the way Dawes plays into, you know, his Diogo's pride and his
and his vulnerability.
Exactly. And kind of seeing, I thought that was really, that's a very timely story to tell at this time. So that was cool. Yeah, and the other thing for me that's really interesting, again, as a book reader,
did you read the books?
I have read the books. I may mention that once or twice in this podcast. But the relationship between, I feel like the relationship between Naomi and Holden in terms of the politics of the belt is a little more fraught in the show than it was in the books.
Okay.
And it makes that dynamic really, really compelling. Because you still see them in bed. I mean, they're still linked. Right. They're so linked and they're so together. But there's such a big, right now anyway, divide between kind of where their loyalties are and where they might end up. And that just makes for a really fascinating view of the relationship, I think, at this time. So,
I mean, if the booty's good, sometimes you can overlook stuff like
that. Yeah, it's like, yeah, sure, he's from Earth, and he doesn't want the belt to win everything, but look at those abs. That's Naomi's inner monologue. I just wrote that.
Speaking of, you can't ever not bring up those abs.
Well, you know.
I know. You're a little Tumblr that exists in the world now. Wonder how that got there. This episode, this is the one, and I said this last week, where everything that Ty and Danielle had told me about Frankie being the right person for Bobby, I saw it. And I think that she did such a great job when she was recalling those events of what exactly happened. And she starts having the flashbacks and the way she's switching emotions so quickly and going from, like, you know, feeling bad that she can't help her fellow Marines and then refocusing back on, like, retelling what's happening and snapping back and forth between emotion and, like, that stoic, strong soldier. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
She did a great job.
That to me, and it's always interesting because I personally enjoy so much more seeing someone selling, I am in incredible pain, but I'm trying to hide it and cover it up and be that stoic person rather than just letting that pain out. I mean, I feel like that's a little, it's when it's done well, and it's so hard to do well, that I'm trying to hold things back, but little bits are leaking out, little pressure points are coming out. And she just crushed it.
Yeah.
And like, I can't remember, they might be Giants had a thing about that where they said that they love writing songs that sound happy but are actually really, really depressing.
That was a really deep cut right there.
Yeah. Well, no, but it's kind of the same thing. It's like watching her veneer of control, but knowing everything that's going on underneath it and seeing it come out in these little spurts here and there was just really a great performance.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously we haven't seen her do that yet because she's been very much in control, very tough Marine.
Plus, we haven't really dived deep into her storyline yet.
Right.
Like, we really only kind of just, we're meeting her in these flashes of what's going on in parallel to the other things that are going on.
Right.
So, but Mars clearly knows more than they're letting on, which that's going to be pretty.
I don't know about that. I think it's more that... They're not letting her know what's going on. It's more about, like, we've got this conflict right now, like, which could very much be a tinderbox that leads to an all-out war between Earth and Mars, which everyone acknowledges would be awful. And everybody's kind of trying to play it for their own advantage. Mars, you know, do they want to get in a shooting war with Earth or not? You know, the belt, obviously, if Earth and Mars, you know, Anderson Dawes makes the point that if Earth and Mars are at peace, the belt loses because then they, you know, can take advantage of them. But if the Earth and Mars are all at war, the belt also loses. So that it's a very thin tightrope that the belt has to walk. And it was really fun for me seeing Fred and Anderson Dawes playing off each other in their different ways of politicking this situation.
And also, I think it's really interesting how in the beginning, you know, Fred Johnson was this. He seemed like he was going to be this villainous character, and now you're starting to realize he's absolutely not that. You know, he's anything.
He wants to use the proto molecule,
it, right? But does he want to have it for the right reasons or the wrong reasons? Let's bring Ty and Daniel into the conversation, since some of this stuff they clearly know because they made it up. So, hi, guys.
Hey.
Why don't we first touch on what you said before? You said something about whether or not Mars knows more than they're letting on,
right,
or they're just not letting her know.
Right.
Which I kind of feel like is the same thing.
Well, no, because I feel like she's being set up as a bit of a pawn. You know, they're sending her to Earth to tell a certain story. And, you know, she's a grunt, ultimately, even though she's a gunnery sergeant. So the politics, it's like a Vassarala. You know, you see a Vassarala playing these big political games. And for a person like Bobby, I feel like that's kind of, not that she can't comprehend it, but it's kind of a foreign thing to her. So I don't know. I don't know where the motivations are at this point from the Martian side.
Okay. Guys, anything? Do you want to shed some light without spoiling?
I think we've done our job then.
There you go.
Okay, then. Yeah. Good talk. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, tell us everything that's going to happen and why.
Well, ultimately, there's the heat death of the universe. But before there's mother stuff. One of the things that I think we've tried to do in the books, and I think is also happening in the show, is a kind of criticism of the idea that a side is good. No matter what side you choose in any conflict, there are good people on that side. There's bad people on that side. There's gradations. There are people who are in it for other reasons than the ones you would expect. One of the things that's been fun for me is watching all the people who are saying that they're on Team Belter or Team Mars, or and thinking, you know, Holden's kind of our protagonist here, and he's the one saying maybe this is a bad framework. Maybe we should listen to him a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to kind of expand on that, one of our goals in the books, and we've kept this in the TV show too, is every character should have their agenda and they should have a good argument for why they're right. And if we can't think of a good argument for each character on why they're doing what they're doing, we won't put it in the show. So, you know, when we present all these differing agendas and people all thinking they're doing the right thing, that's really deliberate, and it does make it hard to pick out the obvious good guy and the obvious bad guy. And that's the point. That's what we're trying to do.
I think that's it's a much more honest representation of things, because if you think about war in general, depending on what side you're on and how you're looking at it, you know, like they always say, like that, I said it last week, you know, one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. So I think that your position and situation, any of those things can seem right, you know? So I think this is a really interesting, an honest way to tell this story, because war is very complicated and it's often includes multiple players in it that sometimes you don't even realize, and it's very convoluted. And
well, and it's just such a human thing. And I think where did I see this? It was maybe on Reddit or someone said, no, it was on Twitter. Someone said that one of the things they loved about The Expanse is that it shows that even if humans can expand out into space,
it's pessimistic, yeah, Star Trek.
We're still assholes.
Yeah, we'll get into space, but we're still assholes.
Yeah, and it's like humans are so tribal, or have been throughout
and
history.
Flawed.
And so this idea that Holden's trying to put out of, you know, we're all on the same team is so counter to all of human history, basically, that you find yourself as a viewer, you know, especially during that debate scene with Fred and Anderson Dawes and Holden chiming in, agreeing with everybody.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's just like, oh yeah, Fred's got a good point. But you know, Anderson Dawes is a good point too. And you can find yourself very easily taking a side.
Because each one of them are speaking from their lived experience.
Yeah.
And their lived experience is very, very different. And that's, of course, going to pepper or how they come about or how they feel or how they come to conclusions, because that's what's happened in their life. And again, this is also what makes the show very, very timely. Just like, you know, watching Diogo go from this like punk kid that's just like trying to steal water, and then, you know, getting in trouble with the police, and then falling in with the OPA, and then becoming, you know, about a cause and passionate about a cause, and then losing somewhat of a mentor, and then becoming very easily radicalized because who else did he have? You know, he doesn't have like a father figure present in his life. You know, he had Miller, that he bonded with, and then for Miller to die and him to, like, you know, I think that this, his behavior is definitely a
Well, Diogo also had an uncle who died committing what the Interplanets would consider a terrorist act. So, you know, the sort of one actual familial father figure he had in his life died as a freedom fighter. So, I mean, it's really easy to see how all of those things added together turned him into what he becomes.
And it's interesting to me because I think from our perspective outside watching Diogo, there's a lot of kind of turns in that story where, you know, he's a punk kid, and then he's victimized, and then he's on the side of the good guys, and then he's on the side of the bad guys. But from Diogo's point of view, I think it's all a straight line.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that he was working with Fred Johnson and Miller, going from that to what he does with the other OPA, that's not really a change for him.
No.
It's all for the belt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's exactly what, even when he was, you know, stealing water, you know, it wasn't for him.
Right.
You know, there was okay, we're poor, people need water. You know,
and he was stealing it from the rich guys.
Exactly.
So yeah, I feel like it's less of a question about him being tempted to the light or tempted to the dark so much as us as the viewers being asked to think about what exactly does it mean to be the good guy in this situation. And we've been asking that this season since Miller shot Dresden.
Yeah. And that's it. And it's interesting because it's like, you know, even though Holden is the protagonist, when you initially think of the lineup, and I know I felt this way in the first season, it's like, oh, it's really hard to, like, who do I, like, really like? Because they're kind of all a little, like, shady, you know? They're all keeping secrets, whatever. But then now you're starting to come to a point where it's like, well, it's not as easy just being like, oh, I like or I don't like this person.
Right.
You know, because they're all at some point doing something that, okay, that's not really a great thing.
The Holden Naomi thing is so tough for me. Because I love both of those characters.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, God, you can just see that. To me, at least, I can see the car crash coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's going to come a point where their priorities and their loyalties are going to come to a head. And
yeah. I mean, I love Naomi, but my, I don't want to say a problem, I'm starting just to feel like, girl, there's too many lies. And it's like, at some point that, like, when do you stop lying? Because it's like, if you are with this person and you're in the situation that you're in, like, what's the point to continue, or what's the point to keep lying?
Daniel and Ty, what is the point to keep lying? Yeah.
Why is she lying?
Well, I mean, she has a belief that they're making a terrible mistake. And she knows that she's not going to be able to convince the other members of her crew of that position. And she's taking independent action to try to keep them from making that terrible mistake. I mean, people do that all the time. And, you know, some of the elements of her sort of personal argument for why she's doing what she's doing turn out to be right. She's not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What ultimately comes from the decision she makes will have both positive and negative consequences, but it's not like she's stupid. It's not like she's, you know, completely misread the situation.
And what Holden wants to do, what the rest of the crew wants to do, is irretrievable. It's not something that you can go back later and undo.
Mm-hmm.
What she's doing is making sure all the options stay open as they see how things unfold. That's not a bad plan.
No, it's not.
And they have they mentioned on the show dropping rocks yet? I'm not sure.
No.
Okay.
We talked about that some in the first season.
Right. That's what I was trying to remember in the first season. I think that's the other thing, too, is that right now, like, the idea of a war between Earth and Mars and what that actually means you know, you see Bobby pushing for it and pushing for it. But when you've got a situation where people can basically throw an asteroid down a gravity well, you know, that's that's the apocalypse, more or less, for a planet. So it's the stakes like are just so high with this in a way that I feel like we can't even comprehend. You know, I mean, on a certain level we can, because we have weapons of mass destruction here, but not on that right. scale.
So this would be more like, I mean, again, it's way bigger than like if we went to war with Russia. You know, it's on 100 times that scale. Yeah. Easily.
But the thing you have to remember is that we were often at war with Russia. We just did it with proxies.
Proxy war. Yeah.
Yeah. True.
So you know, when you look at Earth and Mars in the books and in the show, you're looking at that U.S.-Russia kind of relationship, where both sides have this sort of trust that the other side won't escalate it beyond the point of no return.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about that, it's a really interesting and sort of razor thin worldview that, you know, I mean, we would go fight these proxy wars and we just sort of assume the Russians wouldn't launch nuclear missiles at us. Looking back on it, it feels like we were really walking a tightrope there.
Yeah.
Without really realizing it. And Earth and Mars sort of have that same thing where we can shoot at each other sort of off in the outer planets, and we know it won't come back here. It won't follow us back here. Which as the series goes on will feel less and less like a logical or supportable position.
I know that you guys are, you know, you reference like history and you look back at stuff that's happened, you know, in human history. What do you feel like is the biggest influence when you were coming up with this dynamic between Earth and Mars? Like, was it really US and Russia, or was there a specific war or certain wars at certain times in our history that you were kind of drawing from?
And especially with regards to like tinderbox moments, like the Ganymede thing.
Well, I mean, the sort of their starting place was heavily influenced by the Revolutionary War with, you know, the United States and England, where a colony that was too far away to really successfully control threw off the imperial yoke and became a superpower in its own right. I mean, that really is the Mars story, that it was just too far away for Earth to really maintain control over. It throws off Earth's yoke, and now it's a superpower in its own right. That's what we were doing there. But then once you get into like where the show is now, you know, a couple hundred years later, we really are sort of in that East-West Cold War sort of mentality, where you have two technologically advanced superpowers with very large fleets and lots of missiles staring each other down, and both knowing that they can end civilization if they decide to, and sort of tiptoeing around that fact while they fight their little proxy wars. That is very much a sort of USSR and US in the 70s and 80s kind of feel to it.
And it's very true, because you see, you know, Bobby's basically indoctrination into the idea of, you know, well, Earth is there for us to have a war with, and that's what we're about. That's, growing up in the 80s, I very much remember that antagonistic attitude towards the Soviet Union in culture, in American culture.
Yeah, and I'm sure you remember there was this feeling, almost this feeling of inevitability to it.
Yeah.
Like at some point it was just going to happen and it would be awful, and it was weird sort of living with that hanging over your head. And there were all these weird movies and stuff that were coming out. Remember like The Day After?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And didn't that actually change Reagan? Like Reagan was going to do something and then he saw that movie and he like walked something back after seeing it?
I don't know. I've heard stories like that.
There was a British movie too that I can't remember the name of. It was called Threads, I think, or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but it was this horrible British film about the after effects of a nuclear war. So maybe if certain people in the government are watching The Expanse, they'll realize that war is not the answer.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you read about the history of that, and there are a ton of situations that we look back on now and go, oh my God, we were like 3 seconds from a nuclear war, where it really was down to like one general in a base in Siberia.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there and going, well, maybe not in civilization today, and doesn't press a button. And that's why we didn't have a nuclear war. And the number of situations like that are really terrifying.
Have you guys read the book Command and Control?
No.
You should check it out if you can. It's basically, I should have saved this for the shout outs later, but it's pertinent. It's basically all about the American nuclear arsenal and its management. And there's a ton of stories in there. I mean, basically, I think someone dropped a nuclear bomb on North Carolina by accident and it just didn't go off. Or there was a plane crash or something and the bomb, you know, didn't detonate. But we've been so close to these things happening over and over again.
We dropped one on my hometown at one point, too. There was one that got released over Albuquerque.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, primed.
So these things happen, you know.
But, you know, oops.
Oh, no, yeah, that's fine.
Well, and the famous story is I think there was a Russian commander at one point who saw contacts on radar, and it ended up being a flock of birds. But it was his decision to wait and not press the button and make sure, you know, with the obvious point that he could have very easily been wiped out if it wasn't a flock of birds that kept us from all-out nuclear war.
That's, I mean, we are just such an awful species.
And now we're in space in the expanse, bringing that awfulness everywhere.
We're such an awful species.
Yeah, and so I mean, what we're doing with the expanse is just taking that one step further, where now you've got gigantic fleets of fusion powered spaceships, you know, covered in nuclear missiles, flying around, and you have commanders. I mean, which episode was it where the Scirocco fires nuclear missiles at Phoebe, and the commander of the Nathan Hale, which is the UN ship, has to make a decision. Do I fire back? Were these missiles fired at me? Do I shoot back? And because he doesn't press that button, Earth and Mars don't go to war.
At that moment.
At that moment.
At that moment.
Yeah. 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 At that exact moment, they would have been at war. Except he waited, and the missiles didn't hit, and so he averted a war. So, yeah, I mean, the parallels are very conscious and deliberate.
Can we talk a little bit about Frankie in this episode too? Was any of this part of like the audition process for her, seeing her play out these PTSD scenes?
I don't remember.
Yeah, it was.
Do we have a section from later on in it?
Yeah, the
early bit.
Oh, go ahead.
I was the one I'm remembering of Frankie's audition tapes was from earlier in the season when it was a little more gung-ho.
Yeah, she did that one. That's right. And then they also, because they wanted to see the full range, they had her do her speech about seeing the six UN Marines charging their position and the seventh man, and they weren't shooting at them. They were shooting at the seventh man. She does that whole speech in her audition because they, like Daniel said, they wanted to see the gung-ho version of Bobby where she's kicking ass, but they also wanted to see the sort of vulnerable and traumatized version of Bobby. So they had her do both. And they actually had her come in and do another reading of that before we cast her. And she, you know, she just nailed it every time.
Yeah. That whole part is just so, I mean, that was my favorite part of the episode. Yeah. It really was.
I also enjoyed seeing her tower over the, "quote unquote chaplain" in that scene. I was like, okay, that's Bobby right there. That's great.
I do love that we got an actress in Frankie that she never, even when she's with people who are the same height as her, which often she's taller than people, but every now and then we get somebody who's the same height as her. She never feels intimidated. She never feels like she's like cowering or physically backing off. And she has this sort of natural reaction where somebody steps towards her, she steps toward them, which it just feels very, she feels so physically confident.
Yeah.
And it just radiates off of her that, all of those scenes are fantastic. And this episode has Thorson, right? Okay. Clay Bennett, who plays Thorson, is a gigantic guy. He's huge. He's a beast. And she occupies just as much screen space as he does. She never feels intimidated by him, which is fabulous. I love where we turned out with that.
Yeah, it actually took me a second to, when she mouthed off to him about like, oh, you're sending me there to tell this bullshit story, to realize that he outranked her and that was a total faux pas because she's got such presence. I was like, yeah, man, right on. And then it was like, oh, God, she just mouthed off to a superior officer. That's crazy.
Yeah, no, she's awesome. I want to ask you guys a random question that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. The Belter tattoos. How did you decide, or who thinks up these tattoos, and who decided that the one guy should have the body modification with the skull coming out of his chest?
Well, we have in the first season, we had a makeup department that was responsible for getting a hold of all the various tattoos and worked closely with the art department to come up with the various designs and stuff. And Naren Shankar, the showrunner, had a lot of input in that. And, you know, Mark Fergus as well, who was on set for all of that, had a lot of input. So it really was kind of a team thing to come up with all of that stuff. Now in the second season, some of those departments have changed a little bit. So we're starting to see, I think, a little more of the extreme versions mm-hmm. of those things. But I actually really like it. I love the dude who kind of looks like, who's got like the entire top of his head.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has the Furiosa look, and which of course we were shooting that before Fury Road came out. So that was accidental, but I love it.
All those different tattoos and body modifications remind me of the Krusty Punks in Tompkins Square Park.
The Travelers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Like when I used to live on St. Mark's and 2nd Avenue, like I would always see them, of course. But there was one kid that I always saw that had like his whole half of his face was just completely covered. And I'll never forget this kid. He had the most beautiful blue eyes. And he was actually really good looking if he like wasn't like a junkie and a Krusty Punk. And didn't have a tattoo all over his face. But it just instantly, like, that's what it reminds me of, like, seeing all these
tattoos. It's a great physical signal in a world where we can't have every belter have a larger head and be thinner, you know?
Yeah.
Because
definitely.
Since you can't do that, it's like, oh, that those tattoos are your physical, you know?
Yeah, that's how it differentiates
sign, belter
you.
Belter sign.
We're gonna call Bob because he's been waiting. So let's bring him in.
Okay.
Hello.
Hey, Bob.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
You want to say hi to Ty and Daniel because they're on the line.
Hello, Ty. Hello, Daniel.
Hey, Bob.
Guys, it's really important. Bob really prefers that you call him Sideshow Bob.
Yeah. Ty, the science guy, you bet.
So thank you for making time to join and do this with us today. We have so many people that have so many questions for you about the show, which, by the way, the effects on the show look absolutely beautiful.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. And every week I'm just like blown away by a lot of the stuff that you're doing. And I know you guys use a good amount of practical effects too. So,
well, I wanted to ask first, like, what's it like shooting in space? How does that affect your VFX work? And you
since
know,
you're
how,
really
so
in
how
space.
Yeah, how much of it is actual space and how much of it is VFX?
It's what's really interesting is that I spend so much time in space, I really don't know which way is up anymore. So, it's great to be able to shoot in space because it brings our VFX budget way, way down.
Sweet.
However, our rocket and rocket fuel budget has actually gone through the roof. So we're going to have to change that for next year. But all kidding aside, it's amazing to be able to put my mind into that world, that universe, I should say. Thanks to the words that Ty and Daniel and all the writers write, because it does feel like at times when I watch the shows, it just really feels like I've been there.
Do you, so far, what has been your favorite thing that you've seen come back, like play back on the screen? Do you have something that's your favorite?
There are so many things that are my favorites. I have to say that, first and foremost, and I know this is going to be, the obvious answer, and people are probably going to expect me to say this, but what the hell? It had to be the flip and burn from episode 1 in season 1. Never seen anything like that in science fiction before, and that just kind of set the tone for our show in terms of what we do on a weekly basis. So seeing that flip and burn, being able to describe to, I put it this way. I remember the final shot of the flip and burn, and our VFX vendor who did that sequence as the very aptly named company in Toronto called Rocket Science Visual Effects. And I described to their in-house CG supervisor exactly the shot that I saw in my mind. But I said, imagine a train going down a track, and there was a dolly track circling that train, and the camera's just moving around it as the train's moving down the track. I said, that's what I envisioned for kind of this final shot, and they nailed it. And I just watched that scene every single time. And I go, wow, that is pretty damn awesome. But you know, there's other things like the, you know, the Anubis reactor core in episode 8 of season 1, and the Nauvoo launch in 204 from this season. And of course, the now very, very, very highly respected Julie and Miller scene from the end of 205. It's just beautiful. Absolutely beautiful work.
Was there anything that when you got the script or when you saw a scene described that has you saw as your biggest challenge, or you were just like, wow, how are we going to pull that one off?
The biggest challenge is the organic nature of it. And by that, I mean, like, you know, when you have a spaceship like the Rossi, for the most part, it's a hard body, animation. It's a more, understandable, less subjective, build of a metallic spacecraft. But when, you know, I read the script for 205, and it's like, you know, Julie has been transformed and these tentacles are holding her up. And of course I've read all the books, so I, you know, knew it was coming. That was my, you know, I thought that was going to be our biggest challenge, is how to keep it, organic and fluid and beautiful and heartbreaking on a TV budget.
And I think I saw you posted on Reddit that that was basically just a blue room and her sitting on a mattress, right? Or laying on a mattress.
Yeah, that was all it was. I had specced out a much more sleek back-fitting form for her to be lying on that would have been painted blue, but something got lost in translation, and the director and I, David Grossman, and I did a little set walk through the night before we were about to shoot it the next day. I saw somebody taking this literally a blue mattress from IKEA and forming it kind of in a little bit of a spine shape and wrapping it in blue fabric. And I went, what's that? And they go, oh, that's what Julie's going to be on. I'm like, oh my God, really? So we knew that it was, that scene was going to be in a blue room. I didn't know that she was going to be on a blue mattress, which of course ended up obscuring a lot of her body because she kind of sunk into it. Which the original intent was to do that form fitting back, support so that we wouldn't lose her body, so that we didn't have to paint that all back. But, unfortunately it didn't work out the way I'd expected, but, give credit to Spin VFX in Toronto. They didn't balk. They didn't run. And they took that blue room with Florence and with Tom and a bomb and made it what you saw.
You told me to ask you if you could stop working 7 days a week.
Yeah. And I saw some response saying, yeah, after we finished adapting, you know, the ninth novel. To be honest with you, I would be happy about that. I'd be so happy to just keep on going on this show. Somebody else said on Reddit that, you know, one of the questions they asked me is like, mm-hmm. What's my dream job? I'm already in my dream job. This is my dream job. I've done a lot of movies. I've done, I've worked on X-Men and Nutty Professor 2 and Dr. Doolittle and the Mimic and Splice and, you know, so many great.
Somebody mentions Glitter. That was one of the movies.
Again, really?
So what was it about The Expanse that appealed to you when, you know, the project gets put on your table and you're deciding whether you want to dive in or not?
Well, it's really funny. I came onto The Expanse. I was working with Alcon, who's the production company behind The Expanse. I had just finished Dolphin Tale 2 with them, which is, it could be further away from the type of effects that we have in The Expanse and the storyline. I had done the first Dolphin Tale movie and was finishing Dolphin Tale 2. I was down in Los Angeles, and Andrew Kosov and Broderick Johnson, who are the two co-presidents and CEOs of Alcon, were in a VFX review with me at a theater. And Broderick walked up to me and said, you've done a lot of TV, right? And I did like the Tudors and the Borgias and other TV shows. And I said, yeah. And he goes, we have a show I think we're going to be shooting in Toronto that we'd like to talk to you about. And I hadn't filmed in Toronto for quite some time between the two Dolphin Tale movies. I had done two other movies down in Mexico, and again with the Tudors in Ireland and the Borgias in Hungary. It was intriguing for me to think about doing a show in Toronto after 7 years of not doing a show in Toronto. And I said, sure, I'd love to, you know, talk to you guys more about it. So they had the script sent to me, and they said, after I read the first script, as they were sending me the script, not after I read the first script, I said, the good thing about TV is that you get to amortize things over many, many episodes or seasons. So like, you know, when you build, you know, in the Tudors, for example, Whitehall Castle, we used it for 4 years. Like, so you get a little bit of a budget hit at the beginning, and you have to spend, you know, some money to build the assets, but then you get to amortize it over, over, like I said, many, many episodes or many seasons. And Broderick says, yeah, not so fast. So they sent me the first script, and of course I got to the end of episode one for season one and read what happened to the Canterbury, and we just keep on. And that I think was the thing that compelled me more than anything to want to be on this show. I went, nothing is precious. That is so damn cool. There's nothing precious. Anything can go at any given time. And of course, when I read the script, more than anything that I ever expected, and love the science. And at that point, I knew that I had to be on it.
So somebody asked about Easter eggs, which I know that you guys have a few of them a little bit through the show. Yes, no. So what are some Easter eggs that fans haven't found yet?
Well, there are loads of them. Not speaking on behalf of Ty and Daniel here, but I am speaking on behalf of Ty and Daniel here. We're between the two of them and me and Brett Culp, who's my other VFX supervisor on the show this season. I did it all myself last year as a VFX supervisor, but when we went to 13 episodes, I had to bring Brett on, who I've worked with for 30 years. Between the four of us, we are all Rush fans. The rock band Rush from
Canada. Yes.
And there
Rush.
Are many Rush references in Easter eggs all over. So
oh my God. I have to go back and watch the entire show now. I'm such a huge Rush fan, and I have not caught a single one. That's terrible.
There you go. So, so to start you off, if you get into episode 8 from the first season, when Alex launches the drone to investigate the Anubis, the screen, when he launches the drone, you will actually see on that screen Pert, Lifeson, and Lee.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yep, it's right there. I've got Cygnus X-1 references. I've put Rush references everywhere. And another fun little fun fact is that Rush's final concert was in early August of 2015, and Ty and me and Mark Fergus, we were all at that final concert, sitting about 12 rows from the stage.
It was great. We were actually sitting in the friends and family section, which is kind of awesome.
Yeah, friends and family section. Yes. Yeah. I Geddy Lee's sister and brother both used to work for me. I know their management company, so we were able to get friends and family tickets. So we were 12 rows back from the stage.
That's amazing. If you guys could work in the rapping skeleton from the Roll the Bones video into future episodes of the show, I would be so psyched.
That would be very funny. That would be good.
So aside from the fact that you're Rush fans, how do you guys decide like what kind of Easter eggs you're going to put into something?
Sometimes there are Easter eggs that are put in that come from the writer's room. There's supposedly, and Ty will not tell me where it is, and it's driving me nuts. There's supposedly a Simpsons reference from season one, and I can't find it. And I've seen every episode a gazillion times, and he'll never tell me, and he won't tell you. Other times it's just me. I'm looking at, we're looking at a screen, and we need to put together a string of numbers and letters, as if it's some sort of encrypted, code. And I'll throw in, like Cygnus X1, intertwined with my home address. My home address is actually in the show about four times.
Your home address is in the show?
Yep. About four times. Yeah, but not as a full string. You're not going to get the full string, but you're going to see it. Like I said, it would be, 959 Cygnus X1, and then my street name. You know, it would be that kind of thing.
Ty and Daniel, are there any Easter eggs that you want to share that no one's found yet?
That I want to share?
Yeah. I know you.
Bob's right. The Simpsons one is still in there, and that was actually when it happened in the writer's room. It's actually a reference we came up with because Dan Nowak, one of the other writing producers on the show, and I are huge Simpsons fans, and we were tossing back and forth of some lines that cracked us up. And then Dan turned in a script, and something from what we were tossing back and forth was in his script. I'm actually kind of amazed no one has got it yet, but I have offered a full set of signed copies of the books to whoever figures it out.
Okay.
Challenge I've got a full set of signed copies of the book, so I'm really not motivated.
Is there? I'm surprised, Ty, you haven't like thrown an Archer reference somewhere in there.
Oh yeah.
So
I'm sure there are some.
There's still time. Yeah. The show's still going on. Yeah.
Or like
Naren Shankar, who's our showrunner, is as big an Archer nerd as we are. Mm-hmm. So I would be willing to bet there's some subtle Archer references hiding in there.
Now I'm gonna have to like go back and look for them.
Yeah, there probably would be. Yeah.
My favorite question that I saw on Reddit, Chair, if you don't let me jump in, someone asked, "What's a moment from the show that is an effect that the average viewer might have missed that was an effect that was a VFX moment?"
That's a good question.
Right. Yeah. There are so many of them. I'm going to start with some that might be obvious to people, but maybe not to others. You know, a lot is said about our sets, and our sets are fantastic. You know, our first season, Seth Reed was our production designer, and our second season, Tony Iani, and they both done an amazing job building our sets. Our big stage, our biggest sound stage is called Jumbo for good reason. It's about, I think, 60,000 square feet. And the actors like being on the sets, and but we pack about 8 or 9 active sets onto that stage at every given moment. So we can't, of course, with, for example, Tycho Station in the second season, when you take a look at one of the shots, it goes on and on and on for hundreds of feet. And people might think, well, we built that whole set, because everybody says how great and big and massive the sets are, again, which they are. But we've got so many, we can only, you know, build 60 or 80 feet of it, and we got to stop and put a blue screen at the end. So our set extensions, I think, are pretty damn impressive, whether it's, you know, Tycho this season or last year, Medina or Midtown. Pretty much every angle you looked at, there was a set extension. There are other things like, you know, little bits and pieces that you would never, ever know. For example, in there's an episode tonight. Sorry, I'm not going to say tonight. I shouldn't say that because I don't know when this is going to air. Episode 206, where there was a mistake in Diogo's neck tattoo that was added to him at the end of 205 was not put on him for a big scene. And we had to go through in every shot that we saw Diogo and add that tattoo digitally. In season one, when Miller was in Julie's apartment and he's playing back Julie's messages and sees Julie on the video screen, and he walks over to the counter and picks up her necklace. The connection was supposed to be that she was wearing the necklace in that video, and when we shot the video, she wasn't wearing the necklace, so we had to add the necklace. Again, moving forward to season two, there's a scene in 206 with Avasarala and Iturbi sitting in front of a fireplace. That was a heritage historical home. We could not put a real fire in the fireplace, so that was added digitally. But the big one that nobody would ever guess, I would say that probably 75 to 80% of the visors on the helmets for our Rocinante crew, for our MC, for our Martian Marines, about 75 to 80% of the helmets, the visors are added digitally.
Wow.
Huh. Here's a question that Adam.
So wait, all the helmets have nothing in the front, and you just add the glass and reflection and everything digitally?
Yeah. Get too many reflections of crew. For example, in the beginning of episode one for the second season, we had that Mars battle. We had to have the visors in for that particular scene because of safety, because it was real explosions. There were real explosions going off near the actors. So we had to actually paint out the crew because we were seeing the crew everywhere in those shots. But when we get to Ganymede, they're walking around Ganymede. There weren't any visors in because it was just number one. They were fogging up like, and that's where I made the call. We were inside a soundstage. It was a hot Toronto summer. The difference between the outside temperature, the inside temperature, the outside humidity, the inside humidity. Every time that Sarah and Duchesne, Empo and Frankie put on those helmets, it would fog up so badly you couldn't see their faces at all. Period. So I just said, take them out. So whenever you see Ganymede, and with the exception of one particular moment where Travis, who's played by Empo Kwahu, and Bobby Draper, who's Frankie Adams, obviously they're talking helmet to helmet. We wanted to have that connection, so they are wearing real visors. But everywhere else on Ganymede, they were added digitally completely.
Somebody wants to know how many hours you spent on Stephen Strait's abs. I swear to God, this is a question on Reddit.
And it wasn't posted by me, surprisingly.
It wasn't posted by him.
I mean, you know, I'm speaking from a happily married man's perspective here. But you know, I could easily spend many hours watching his abs. We haven't had to do anything to them. His abs are his abs.
Not even a little highlight, a little good, you know, extra lighting or anything. No, it's all natural.
Those are all practical, man. The abs are practical.
Those are damn good practical abs. Now, we did have to spend some time on his ass, however. that was in, I don't know if anybody has seen the Carson Daly bit with Steven on it. And he basically starts it off by saying that the first day of shooting on set was the first day that Steven and I met, you know, episode one, season one. And he was doing a zero sex scene, and he had these really large straps around his ass, holding him up in the air so that Ade could be on top of him with the blanket. And the director wanted to actually see his ass. So that meant I had to, you know, get a camera and shoot stills of Steven's ass later on without the straps so that we could rebuild it and put it back on so that it didn't look like the straps were there. And Steven's going, "That's a great way to meet Bob. First day on set." It's like, "Hey, can I talk to you for a second?" And Steven's like, "Yeah."
Hey, guys, Bob always tells that story, but the truth is the director did not ask for that.
I've been.
I was going to say, that's TV magic right there.
Sounds like you and Adam should just kind of have a little alone time. You could talk to each other, write fan fiction.
We don't need to talk. We just need to look at, we just need to exchange pictures of Stephen Strait.
Or they could go to your little Tumblr, stephenstraitsabs.tumblr.com.
That's right. Soon to be the highest trafficked site on the internet. I
know.
Yeah.
I can't wait till that goes live, like goes out there and everybody's on it. What was another question? Somebody asked, what are some other shows that you think have really good visual effects?
The one on the top of the list, obviously, and it might not have been this way in the first few seasons or a couple of seasons, but now it is. It's Game of Thrones, without a doubt. I mean, Game of Thrones is just absolutely fantastic. But there's another one that it just keeps blowing me away again and again and again and again by how great the visual effects are, and it's Black Sails. They're flawless. Like, they're, you know, and I also like Vikings, and they do kind of the same kind of thing in Vikings. But Black Sails just keeps knocking it out of the park in terms of their effects. And I did enjoy Stranger Things and Westworld and to a certain extent Black Mirror. But I don't think there are many, science fiction shows that are kind of in the same, realm. I'm not going to say anything negative about any other shows, of course, but, our show in the science fiction category, I think is pretty far up there, but I've got to say, in terms of fantasy, Game of Thrones and Westworld and period pieces, Black Sails and Vikings, they're really, really quite fantastic shows.
Bob, what made you get into visual effects? Like, was there like a certain movie that you saw once when you were younger and you were like, "That's what I want to do," or did you just kind of like fall into it?
I wish I could say that was the case. I've wanted to be in the film industry for quite some time because of a single movie that I saw back in the early 80s that had no visual effects in it whatsoever. It was the moment where I realized that a person had actually crafted this, and I understood at that point what a director was, and I'm very happy to say this director has become a friend of mine. It was a film called A Soldier Story with Denzel Washington. And it was directed by Norman Jewison, who was a Canadian director. And I was living in Florida at the time. I mean, I wasn't even living in Canada. Florida is where I grew up. And I saw that movie, and I just remember sitting at the end of the film watching the credits roll and went, I now understand that somebody actually put this movie hasn't always existed, and it wasn't just pulled out of thin air. Somebody actually crafted this. And then I ended up moving to Canada about a year later to go to university. And met a young woman in university who, you know, we fell in love, got married, and are still married, and, you know, have two grown children. And that's the reason why I kind of stayed here. But as I finished my fine arts degree, one of my college classmates came in and said, there's a brand new program in computer animation coming that's just started. This is like 1984. And would you be interested in applying? Because they only accept people who have fine arts degrees. And I went, no, I'm going to do I'm a painter and a photographer. I don't make art on computers. Are you kidding? Mm-hmm. And I said, where is this school? And he said, Oakville, Ontario. And I went, that's where my girlfriend lives. So yeah, I get to stay in Canada for one more year if I go take this, this 1 year diploma course. So I applied and got in, ended up, like I said, marrying Tori and staying in the area and got into the film business. And, in 1995 did a movie called Cube. And that was produced by the Canadian Film Center. And we donated about $500,000 worth of visual effects for that movie. And as a result, they asked me to come on to the board of directors of the Canadian Film Center. And the Canadian Film Center is the school that was started by Norman Jewison. So I've been on the board for over 20 years and was chairman of the board for 5, and Norman's become a dear friend. And so I got interested in filmmaking because of a great film called A Soldier Story. And I got into computer animation and visual effects because I fell in love with a woman who happened to live in the same city as a school that taught that.
Wow.
So I'm going to ask all of you a question. So I know a lot of the times in science fiction, like when we see movies decades later, the visual effects don't always hold up. Like practical effects tend to better than any type of CGI or anything like that. When you're creating the shows and the feedback that you get or the feedback that you give Ty and Daniel, which I know a lot of it's coming from Ty, are you ever thinking like how this is going to age and like trying to find a way to use the effects in a way so that it ages really well?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I do think that a lot. And it's kind of funny. I was on a VFX review Skype and CineSync call with Noreen yesterday. And I said, you know, just the other day I was having trouble falling asleep. And I thought because I'm you know, awake, I just wanted to watch episode one again from season one, not season two, from season one. I said, wow, the effects really hold up. He goes, well, I hope so. They're only a year old. So, you know, but again, I'm thinking like, how did the effects hold up? But we did a movie, in 1996 or 97, called Fly Away Home. And I look at that, you know, every single time I look at that, it's kind of flawless. You know, did another movie in 2006 or 2007 called Splice. And again, I look at the effects in there and they still hold up. I don't know what we could have done better. So it does actually, cross my mind all the time. I mean, Ty made a comment many months ago, and he put this on Twitter. The first time I showed him a rough edit, rough animation, previs, whatever you want to call it, of the Nauvoo launch from the fourth episode, and he said on Twitter, like, you know, that thing where the best sci-fi movie you've seen all year is a grayscale animation. And I knew that was going to be one of those things I'm going to look at, you know, years from now and go, yep, still holds up, still works. So
I appreciate the credit, but I think that was actually Daniel that said that.
You're like, oh, really? Oh, it was nice. That was Daniel. That wasn't me.
I sometimes say things. I'm comfortable with Ty getting the credit though. That's fine.
Well, Ty always takes the credit. You know that, Daniel, come on.
It's either, and no matter what it said, it's either Shakespeare, Ty, or Oscar Wilde. So,
so has there been any instances where you guys did not agree with a finished product? Where
I still give Bob shit, and he deserves it over that over that terrible wrench flub from the second episode.
I can read the script to you right now, Ty. I can read it, and it wasn't shot that way.
I just started.
And you're, but it was more. I still, but you know what? I'll take the bullet for it. I will take the bullet for it. And it was just as I said to somebody.
You just finished not taking the bullet for it. You just seconds ago didn't take the bullet.
It was windy on the surface of the night. They were going very, very fast.
Oh, okay.
Has
well, global warming will cause extreme weather in space.
And that's it. They hit a thermocline. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to die. Might not know what that is, but they hit a thermocline. There you go.
Hey, there are things about space that we don't fully comprehend.
Well, now I'm going to ask this question.
That's true.
Do you guys ever? There's
some things about space that some of us don't comprehend more than others.
All right, I'm not coming back for season three.
Do you guys ever get comments back from like science fiction fans that like start? Which I saw this, I think, the other day. I saw somebody like tweet something that was kind of like they had a problem with something that was showed on the show, because of course. But like, do you ever get comments from people that are like, well, actually, like this should be going this way, or how come that, or it wouldn't work like that in space, like that you just are like, dude, no way.
So here's the thing that some people are legitimately not understanding something and going, oh, I didn't think it would work that way. And that's totally fine. When Fred throws the black sky belter off the space station and the guy falls down out of the airlock, a lot of people didn't understand that. And so, you know, I'm fine on Twitter going, actually, what's happening here? And I'll explain it. And then you occasionally get people who are nitpicking because they want you to see how smart they are. And I mostly just ignore those people because they've already gotten their jolly by posting the thing. I don't need to respond. And then there's this third group that gets really angry at you for messing something up, and it becomes very clear that they don't understand how the thing works. And those people I find super annoying because they want to be nitpicky. They want to like take you to task for your terrible science, and you're reading what they're saying and you're like, you don't actually understand science. And you're trying to lecture me on it. Those are the only ones I find annoying.
Do you ever respond to them?
Not to those, no. Well, occasionally I do, but it's always just snarky.
What about you?
Sometimes, Bob? I'm a dick on the internet. I can't help it.
What about you, Bob?
Well, you're a dick in real life to me.
Well, yeah.
You like Kalen. You hate me.
No, dude. This is how he expresses affection.
That's what it is. All right.
This is true. But I've been told that if he didn't do that, then that meant he didn't like you.
Okay, that's true. After almost 3 years, I should know this. I mean, I had to deal with a comment the other day that their notion of the science was completely wrong. And Narain just keeps saying, why do you even respond? And I'm thinking, you know, Ty's probably thinking the exact same thing. He says, well, because I care about the show and I don't want people to think that we're not paying attention and that we're doing things wrong. I completely 100% agree with Ty about, you know, the three different categories. And the ones that do really quite annoy me are the ones where people are, you know, indignant about what they believe is the real science. And then they are completely wrong. And, you know, keep in mind, I've got a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. I'm not a physicist. I'm not an engineer. Narain is. And after, you know, what I hope will be many, 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 many more years on this show, someone damn well better give me an honorary PhD in physics. I've had to learn so much over the last 3 years. But, you know, I think the way to take a look at how we're approaching the science and the way that you know, people are responding, you know, Ty and Narain and a few of our actors, they did a panel at Caltech a few weeks ago that I thankfully was in Los Angeles for and was able to attend. And you've got real astrophysicists, you've got real, you know, astronomers, you've got real engineers on this panel in this audience. And they were just going nuts about how well we do the science. They were so complimentary. You know, the questions were remarkably on point. And even Jessie Christensen, who we all love, she's an astrophysicist. I believe she's an astrophysicist at Caltech. She was just remarkably charming. And she said that there was one moment in one of the episodes from the first season where she looked over at her husband, who also is a professor at Caltech, and was like, I can't believe they did it. I was like, they were applauding. They were jumping up and down. So yeah, we get the crap every now and then from people who think they know better, but we also get the props from the people who actually do this science for a living.
I want to ask, and I know we're running a little long here on time, but specifically about the protomolecule and the execution of that on screen. I talked to Ty and Daniel about this a little bit. Basically, reading the book, I tended to read it more as this body horror type of effect, and to see it rendered as this, as a glowing blue thing, it was very different, but like, it's really beautiful the way it's done. Can you talk a bit about the conception of that, the design of that, and how that's been executed on screen?
Yeah, it really kind of starts from you know, Daniel's and Ty's and Rain's minds, and then we have these two fantastic concept artists in Toronto, Ryan Denning and Tim Warnock, and they came up with concept art and the look. And it's the same way with pretty much every movie, even like an animated film that Disney does. You've got concept artists who create the look, the lookbook, the color keys, whatever you want to call it. So these guys came up with the look. I'm sure, again, Ty, Daniel, Narain, feedback loop between Ryan and Tim. And then we're presented with these concepts. And then I've got to take that to the company that I have chosen to do those visual effects, which I think I mentioned before earlier in this podcast, is Spin in Toronto. And said, this is what we are trying to achieve. Now they've got to actuate that. They've got to they've got to put that into motion. They've got to make it work using live action footage with real actors and stay true to the concept, which they did a remarkably great job at. It really kind of starts for something like this. I mentioned before how difficult it is because it's quite organic. That entails what we call simulation, meaning that you can't possibly animate every single thing that's moving in that frame. You take the Rocinante and move it from screen right to screen left. That's an animator going, okay, here's the Rossi over here, click, keyframe. 38 frames later, here's the Rossi over here, click, keyframe, computer, you do the rest. With organic type animation, you can't do that. You have to run it through a simulator. And you have to give that simulator effectively instructions to be able to create the motion and the behavior of whatever you're trying to create. So at the Spin, they've got this guy by the name of Tim Sibley. Tim is just an absolute genius at that. So you give it to Tim and you say, here's what we got, here's what we want. You figure out how to write the code to animate it. So there's not there's not an animator making a human walk or a spaceship fly. There's a guy writing code who then applies that code and you get that animation. After that point, when the animation is approved, it then gets lit, rendered, then sent to the compositing department. And their head of compositing at Spin is Andrew Scott. And he adds all the stuff like the fireflies and the underskin glowing of Julie and all the other stuff that kind of goes, backwards, forwards, up, down, in terms of color and light. And so it's a real, and of course they have teams, like they're not doing it just themselves. So it's a hugely collaborative effort and it's remarkably technically difficult to the point where, I really rarely did simulation when I was an animator. I tried to stay more into hard body animation just because I wasn't talented enough to be an effects simulation artist. So that's how it all happens. And it takes months. Like that scene, we started working on that scene back in like April.
Wow.
Is there anything, and this is the last one because we really are like going, but is there anything coming up in season two that is like jaw dropping special effects wise?
I can answer that one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
There you go.
Well, then there you go.
Yes.
I would love to again, knowing some of what's coming, I would love to have Bob back at some point to really
get into that. Yeah, definitely.
There's some stuff coming up that's going to be – I'm really excited about seeing rendered on screen.
There's some stuff coming up that's jaw-dropping.
Okay, cool.
Seriously.
So, Bob, we're going to have you back probably towards like the end of the season. Is that cool?
I'm happy to do so, only if you actually refer to it as visual effects rather than special effects.
I'm sorry, visual effects.
It's okay, sure.
I should know better because I see that it's VFX, and I don't know why I keep saying special effects because
everybody does it. I'm just being an ass.
It's okay. I'm used to ties. So you're really fine.
Oh yeah. Well answered.
I'm desensitized now. It's fine. Awesome. Thank you for joining us today.
You're very, very welcome.
Bye. We'll talk to you soon.
Am I remembering correctly that the whole kidnapping of Cortazar thing, this is not from the books as well, right?
This was not shown in the books. It's the backstory
of
The Vital Abyss, the novella where Cortazar actually appeared first in the books.
Because it seems like a major, this is going to be a major, it was such a big cliffhanger at the end of the episode leading into this chase after these guys and where this is going to lead us. Why the decision to bring that on at this point in the story?
To move the story forward?
Well, yeah, no, sure. I mean, I'm just...
Sorry.
So, I mean, Cortazar winds up in a place, in a certain place in the books that becomes very important to the later story. And because we had brought him on to Tycho, we needed to make some moves to sort of connect those two things so we could get Cortazar to where he eventually needs to be for his longer story to play out, but still get all the great scenes with him on Tycho with Amos and all that stuff. So having Dawes sort of take him off the station was our way of getting that connection back again. Because he does, in the story Vital Abyss, he does wind up in the control of the OPA. And then from there, gets handed off to somebody else. But so now we've got him back in under the control of the OPA.
Where we need him to be for the later books. And
where we needed him to be, yeah.
Is there anything that has not happened up to this point? Without spoiling anything, but anything that we're past in the books that we didn't get to use that you regret or you wish you were able to use in the books?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So, like, is there
anything from the books that hasn't appeared in the show that you kind of wish had gotten in there but couldn't because of the constraints
that we're past
of the show?
That point, so it doesn't matter, so you're not spoiling anything? Is there anything from the books behind where we are?
I'm sorry that we're not going to get Sorin. I'm sorry that we're not going to get Avasarala's second in command, her assistant from Caliban's War, because I liked him and I liked how his interaction with Bobby would have played out. But
we do wind up getting some of that with Katyar, but it is a very different kind of relationship.
Yeah.
And mostly Daniel's just upset because he would have cast Rob Lowe as Sorin, and he just wants to meet Rob Lowe.
Are you serious?
No. That was completely made up on the spot. But I'll go with it.
Okay.
No, you told me when I was writing Sorin scenes, always write them as if he's Rob Lowe from West Wing.
Well, now I've completely re-envisioned all those scenes in my head. That's great.
So all right, so let's do our shout out. So what are you guys into this week that you want to shout out?
Well, Torment released yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So it's downloaded. I haven't played it because I have a bunch of other shit I need to get done before I can play it. But it is now officially on my PlayStation 4. So the moment that I get anything else done and open up a hole in the schedule, I'll definitely be diving into that.
So Cher, Torment is a computer role-playing game. It's a sequel to Planescape, or the spiritual sequel, I should say, to Planescape Torment, which was a Dungeons & Dragons-based RPG that came out years ago.
I don't care.
Planescape Torment is probably one of the best RPGs ever to be released for the PC. Ever.
But is it... What's the one that I like?
I don't know.
You're the one that told me to play it.
Dragon Age?
Yes. Inquisition.
Yes. But it's very different than that. But it's by the same company. Well, Planescape Torment was by the same company, I believe. Is that a BioWare game?
That's the only RPG that I like. Yeah.
No, Ty and Daniel, was Planescape Torment a BioWare game? I can't remember.
It was. I think it was Black Isle, actually.
Right. That's right.
Which a lot of those guys became BioWare.
Yeah.
But actually, Torment is an In Exile game, which is the the guys from the really old days. The guy started in Exiles, the guy who did the first Bard's Tale in like the 80s.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's very exciting. I didn't know that was out. Now I know what I'm doing tonight.
Okay. What's the next shout out we got?
I'm reading the advanced reader's copy of a book called Brimstone by Sherry Priest, who is one of my favorite contemporary horror fantasy writers. And I don't know if this one's out yet. I think it's coming out in a couple months still, but it's good. She's good. She has never steered me wrong, and this one's working well too.
Okay, so now I'm just pissed off because I always get arcs of Sherry's books before they come out, and I didn't get an arc of this one. So now I've decided Sherry is my enemy.
Yeah, you still have the Cameron Hurley like hardback that I didn't get, so I think you're still ahead.
You guys are so competitive.
Yes.
Adam, what about you?
I'm going to shout out the Expanse's lead-in, The Magicians. The sci-fi show The Magicians. Now, admittedly, I am not watching season two yet because because I had to go back and I saw the pilot many years ago when they first showed it to those of us who worked at sci-fi. I was working at sci-fi proper at the time and didn't love it, you know, but then
I remember you saying,
yeah,
you
but then
it.
I heard that it got better. So it's on Netflix. Season one is on Netflix and I am catching up with The Magicians and I'm enjoying it much more. I'm a big fan of the books by Lev Grossman. So it's very interesting to see the way they're handling that adaptation.
Okay. I don't think I have anything to shout out.
All right. Good talk.
But I would like to say that last week I did shout out Moonlight and then went and won Best Picture.
There you go.
So
yeah, I got a screener of that. Uh-huh. I think even before it came out in theaters. And I was talking it up to Dominique Tipper is the one who said, definitely watch that when you get your screener. I watched the screener right away, and she was absolutely right. It's actually kind of stunning that movie ever got made.
Yeah.
So said $1.5 million budget. Unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to shout it out again because I really think everybody should be watching that movie. Has anybody seen Get Out yet?
Yeah.
No, not yet, but that's on my list.
It's excellent. Okay. Everyone should see it. It's just an incredibly well-made film, above all. I mean, there's everything else is good. You know, the writing is good. The social commentary is excellent. The performances are all great. But, like, for Jordan Peele to have made a movie that well put together in his debut effort is unbelievable. It's tight. The pacing is excellent. Like, it's just a great film.
Cool. All right. Well, I guess that's it for us this week. So, if you enjoyed the show, as always, go on to iTunes and give us 5 stars or wherever you listen to us. If you have any questions or you just want to like say hi, you can find us on Twitter at Sapphire Wire. And or sometimes we peruse the Expanse Reddit. And if you, like Adam, love Stephen Strait's abs, you can always go to stephenstraitsabs.tumblr.com.
You can and should.
You go should there. Do both those things. Yes. And we'll see you guys next week. So thanks, guys. And yeah, that's it.